Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky. Very cool guest today, Andy. On May 21st, HBO will debut All the Way. It tells the story of Lyndon Johnson, played by the always awesome Bryan Cranston, starting just after the assassination of John F. Kennedy through the election of 1964, including the process of passing the landmark Civil Rights Act. It's an adaptation of the Tony Award-winning play by Robert Shankin. The director is Jay Roach. He's done an incredible variety of work, from the Austin Powers movies and Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers. He directed Trumbo, and he's won four Emmys, I should say, two of which came for directing Recount and Game Change, also for HBO. And Jay Roach joins us now. Jay, thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. That's really cool.
Off to a good start. We both have had a chance to see the movie, and we really enjoyed it. From your perspective, what did you think about Lyndon Johnson before you started the project? What did you know about that era, his best qualities, greatest failings, and all that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the whole movie. you'll get a lot more watching the film than you will from me talking about it. But I'll give you a few sort of aspects of what drew me to it. When we think of LBJ, I think it's tough as you look backwards in time to see through Vietnam. I mean, the escalation of Vietnam was such a complex policy nightmare for LBJ and for the country. And he was also a president that's between JFK and Nixon. So people tend to sort of forget about how much incredible legislation he accomplished in the first two or three years, what an interesting and compelling character he was. And I frankly, myself had forgotten quite a bit of it. And this particular 11-month period is fascinating because he gets the job he always wanted pretty much his whole life. Even as a kid, he talked about wanting to be president, but he gets the job in the worst possible way after JFK's assassination. And instead of kind of, hunkering down and helping the country just recover from that, which alone was a pretty major thing, he took on civil rights, one of the most combustible issues of the time, and ended up passing, the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 with the help of the civil rights leaders in league with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so it's all based on Shankin's play, and I saw the play, and I was like, oh man, this is a much, much richer story than I remembered, and let's figure out how to make it into a movie.
And we'll get into all the issues involving the civil rights and the politics about it. But one of the things that really struck me about the movie and reminded me of some of your work before, Jay, is LBJ is a real Texan. I mean, he is as Texas as people get. And he looks in a lot of ways out of place in the White House. And it reminded me of some of the just culture clashes that have come up in your movies in the past, whether you're talking about, Austin Powers and the world that he's in, or like Meet the Fockers, the different families, and just it seemed like something that would be fun for you to explore as a director who's been through that before.
That's a really interesting connection. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I have even thought of it that way. But on the other hand, I am always intrigued by stories where the predicament, of the story involves people who wouldn't ordinarily be in the place they find themselves in, or are up against, or locked together with people they wouldn't otherwise get along with. And how does that happen? How does that work out? I mean, that kind of suspense is always interesting to me. My parents are Texan. I spent all the summers of my youth in Amarillo, Texas. I'm very familiar with the kind of Texan state of mind and state of being. And it is true that part of LBJ's predicament was that he inherited this job from from royalty in a way, in a certain way, Camelot and the Kennedys and the Eastern East Coast elite aristocracy, and he comes in having gone to, you know, West Texas Teachers College, I think it was called, and is working with all these former Kennedy Harvard people, you know, and so he probably couldn't have been more of a misfit, and yet he had been, you know, a congressman in for a U.S. in House of Representatives for a dozen years. He had been a senator for a dozen years, vice president for three something years, and so he, on the other hand, was as comfortable as maybe any president has ever been with the legislative process. So it was a really interesting mix of kind of, I don't know, burdens and capabilities. And that's what you find out is the more you learn about Johnson is everything is a kind of pretty crazy paradox with him. He was incredibly charming, but he could also be a bully. He was incredibly kind, but he could also be cruel to people in his personal life and people worked around with. He was driven, but he also could find himself curled up in bed for two or three days during the Democratic convention, thinking nobody loved him and the South was going to abandon him, and he'd just resign and go back to the ranch. You know, he was a really, really, really complicated guy, and that he could accomplish so much. You know, he didn't just pass the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act the next year. He got legislation that gave us Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, immigration reform, you know, programs, the National Endowment for the Arts, AFI, PBS, you know, NPR, like all these incredible programs in just a couple years, the amount of things he accomplished. So he was a misfit, but he also, in a way, was right at home.
Yeah, and one of the ways, I think, was his political acumen, the way he understood the machinations of power. And I've you know, read at least where, you know,
yeah.
you've been always somebody who's been interested in politics. Even, you know, I actually mm-hmm. went back and watched Game Change, you know, before this and reviewed some others, mm-hmm. you know, just went back and looked at some of these things. And like, even those things which deal obviously with politics, and we'll talk about that in a minute, Johnson dealt with, like, politics, and there's a certain enthusiasm and excitement that is mm-hmm. built around just how to make government work. For you,
yeah,
where does that part of the story kind of play in, both for you as a director, as somebody as part of the storytelling and those things?
Well, absolutely, it's a huge part of what I was trying to convey was this man's belief in government as a force that we create. It's our government. It's us. You know, there's so much, I don't know, sort of unfortunate effort to delegitimize what government is, which is basically, in my opinion, it's kind of attacking us. We set it up. We authorize everything that goes on as a majority. And there are people who, you know, on a regular basis who run for office attacking government, saying government is the problem, not the solution. There have been candidates in recent times who wanted so much to abolish every agency, they couldn't even remember the names of those agencies. They just said, we're going to abolish them, you know, and in the middle of the debate. And that is what's great about watching Johnson, because he not only came from a kind of background, and I do think it's a sort of Texan pioneer spirit based on my own parents, you know, who are pretty conservative, but who are can-do people, like just about going in and trying to figure it out, focus on the solutions. And he not only believed government could do it, he insisted that everybody around him get on that program and not come up with excuses, but come up with ways to get things done. And that's refreshing, you know, and I hope it's inspiring. I hope it's in this campaign. I hope it contributes to a conversation about what is leadership and what there's this great line that he says, people are trying to talk me out of taking on civil rights because it's controversial. It's going to be really hard. I'm going to get beat up and I may even lose the election when I run in 64. But if I can't do this, if I can't try to right this level of injustice, what's the presidency for? And that's that's amazing. You know, that really got to me and reminded me, like, oh, right, this is what people who actually believe in what government can do can accomplish if they want to.
And yet there's great stuff in there. It's not a heroic portrayal in the sense that you run away from Johnson's flaws. I mean, there's some great scenes in the film where Johnson just berates Hubert Humphreys, played by Bradley Whitford.
poor Lady Bird.
Right. And, yeah. You know, for being, you know, this a soft liberal, and he throws the L word, as it's, you know, called in politics, as an insult. And all of these programs,
yeah,
which we would today be considered,
yeah, by calling him a weak liberal.
Right.
Yeah,
and I mean, he uses,
he's a, you know, lot the, more centrist than, you know, and a lot more conservative than people remember.
But he throws around, you know, very coarse language, some of which is, you know, would be considered, you know, ethnic sort of slurs and all these other things at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's not an attempt to try to sanitize him, at least in
not at
my
all
sense.
Not at all. And as earnest as I'm making him sound, you know, because I can be earnest, you know, it's quite clear that he was a flawed man, that he did love power. He was sort of attached to, you know, power, and was very, very ambitious. And he was very tough on Lady Bird, on Humphrey, as you say. There's one of the most tragic stories for me, the most interesting stories. His closest aide, Walter Jenkins, who had been with since 1938, who helped him, you know, win every election he won, and then ends up being his kind of chief of staff. He didn't have a formal chief of staff, but Walter was the way into LBJ and for every possible person who was trying to get to him. He gets caught 3 weeks before the election in a YMCA bathroom, getting to know an older gentleman, and apparently he had been caught in 1958 as well in the same bathroom, and no one knew about it. But when this comes out, Johnson immediately, accepts his resignation, and they float the story that he just had a mental breakdown in the hospital. And they just really had to throw him under the bus, and Johnson didn't hesitate. And there's this great recorded phone call of Lady Bird saying, "Honey, we're not going to abandon our friend." He says, "Bird, we have to. It's the presidency at stake." And she says, "Well, I know this is what you think you have to do, but I'm not going to abandon him." Well, they had to, you know. And it's the harshness of their reality and the intensity of Johnson's ambition comes through. So he definitely wasn't a saint, and that's part of what, you know, that's part of what the story is about. Martin Luther King, his kind of partner in some of these fights, wasn't a saint either, and that's part of the story as well. He was an incredible ally and helping in this battle for civil rights. But the story is about two men as opposed to just about politics.
Yeah, one of the things that I found really interesting in the movie, and it's from the perspective of both the politicians involved, but also the people that the politicians would affect, is the movie really drives home how hard it can be to manufacture change and how important patience is to the process of change, but also just how painful it can be for those forced to exercise patience. You know, there's that scene where MLK is telling his constituents that, you know, that a voting rights act that's incomplete is still a significant step forward. And he is right.
Right.
But at the same time, it's very difficult when you're waiting around for equality to just say, "I'm going to wait a little bit longer."
No, and that's an excruciating part of that whole story, because one of my other incredible revelations for me was discovering the sort of quality of the fight from the grassroots civil rights leaders, Fannie Lou Hamer especially, mm-hmm. who goes and testifies at the Democratic convention, because the Mississippi delegation has zero African Americans, even though the state is nearly half African American, and the injustice of that is so insane. And you're right, there was a very strong push to accept this ridiculous inequity and injustice, and yet even just to have a token representation at the time, King's recognized, was a step in the right direction. The next year they pass voting rights, and out of the 64 convention, it completely changed the way the Mississippi delegation was chosen and a percentage of African Americans from then on were represented. But it's very tough to say to people, this is just completely unacceptable. This is absolutely not democratic to have zero representation. There were all the literacy tests and poll taxes and all sorts of attempts to prevent African Americans from even registering to vote, and people were killed over it. And still, Johnson had to depend on Dr. King to convey the message that we are going to make progress. As King said, the moral arc is it bends towards justice, but it takes a long time. We're going to get there, but you have to trust me I'm not going to back down. It's just going to take a while, and that's the pain of those kind of compromises, which I think part of our political system is running from that pain, and therefore no compromises are made sometimes.
Exactly.
Is a really interesting contrast to what goes on now.
Jay, one of the things I loved about the movie, and I love about these sorts of historical movies, and I ended up doing the same thing with Game Change and Recount, is there is existing media that can show you what these events look like. You can go back and watch Johnson's.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can watch, and I did. I went back and watched Johnson's address to Congress after the Kennedy assassination. I actually went back and watched Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony and all of those things. When you create these kinds of historical dramas, where you're telling stories, what is the balance for you between storytelling and the historical accuracy? Because, there's a framework that a two-hour or two-and-a-half-hour movie puts you in where you have to make, I would think, compromises here and there, at different points.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting dilemma, a set of dilemmas. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is what we keep in mind all the entire process is we have to get this right. We have this much time. We are making a deal with the audience that if you give us your attention for these couple of hours, you've been told this is based on history, on real people, and we can't get that wrong. We showed the film at the LBJ Library last night. Lucy Baines Johnson was there. A ton of people who've been in Johnson's staff, and many, many Texans who revere Johnson and Lady Bird were there. And those kinds of screenings are going to happen. So you don't get it wrong. You just can't. At least in terms of the essence of the characters and what they believe in. And you try to get the details right. You try to get the look of the offices, the clothes, the makeup in Johnson's case, Humphrey's case, you don't sleep until you get as much of it down as you can so that someone like, Lucy Baines Johnson can look at it and say, I see my father there. And it's just a requirement, you never get entirely there. You can't. But in terms of the overall historical accuracy, someone asked me on we were doing Trumbo, how much of this is not true? And I said, all of it. You realize they're actors, right? You realize we're on set and they're wearing makeup. And it is a facetious answer, but it's meant to get at the idea that be skeptical of these movies. You have to be. We're taking an 11-month, unbelievably complicated time period, unbelievable complex things that went on and thousands of characters that, we can only barely represent, when we definitely are even only getting the kind of chips over the icebergs of these individuals that we spend time on. So we try to get the essence of it and get it right and tell a story that makes you very interested enough. And then I hope at least that people will do exactly what you did, which is go find the great Caro books about LBJ. Read Taylor Branch's book about Civil Rights Movement, Pillar of Fire. It's an amazing book. Check out the many great documentaries and you go online and look at the real footage. We've saved you a little of that trouble because we put a lot of the real footage in our film. I always intercut some of that archival footage to kind of help take the time machine, back so you can look out that window and also you can compare the look of our film to the actual footage. But I think our responsibility is first and foremost to tell a great story that makes you interested in it, you know, and then leave the really detailed historical account to people like Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know, who's one of our consultants and who worked with Johnson and then wrote a really, really excellent book about LBJ that that I used as a resource.
Yeah, she's good. Her story checks.
She's pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good, yeah.
It's funny. Andy and I were talking about some of the things like you in terms of recreating things, whatever we were talking about, and I know Andy was incredibly impressed with Cranston's physicality. And
there are times where he seems like he's using a different body, like his neck gets weird and his shoulders get all gangly and longer.
Right. And you can, you know, you can make him up with prosthetics and, you know, and his ears and the nose and all that. Mm-hmm. But like, what do you do? Cause like Johnson was a really big guy. He was like 6'4", 6'5".
Yeah.
And Bryan Cranston's not, he's a, you know, under 6 feet tall and fairly thin. Like as, mm-hmm. what do you do about those kinds of things, which are so important to a person's presentation and so fundamental to Johnson? When, you know, is it like Lord of the Rings, or, you know, like Hobbits and stuff? Visual, you know?
I wish, it would be fun if we had that level of visual effects and motion control. But yeah, it's not like he goes and performs on a stage and like a Gollum, you know, you just recreate the 3D, the 3D Johnson on film. No, that is Brian's, that's his wizardry and magical power there. He was a character actor for many years, way before he was famous, you know, and was fantastic on shows like Malcolm in the Middle and many dramas as well before he becomes famous on Breaking Bad. And I think that is always a good thing because he's so busy just acting and perfecting his craft on stage and shows. And by the time he gets to something like this, he has performed it, by the way, you know, dozens and dozens of times, nearly 100 times, I think, on Broadway, and won the Tony for it. So he's already lived it. He's so in it. He doesn't even really have to think about it. In this case, the trick was to have it seem even more realistic as in naturalistic as compared to the stage performance, which has to deliver to the back row of the upper balcony in a 1,400-seat theater. Here, I knew that it would become cinematic, partly because Robert Schenken, who wrote the screenplay and the play, opened it up and gave us scenes like the Amphicar scene and, you know, scenes on the LBJ Ranch, but that Brian would tailor his performance for those intimate scenes where those insecure moments, the self-pitying moments, the intensely fierce, persuasive moments when he's right in the faces of some of those senators, giving them the Texas twist, as he called it, to get on board with his legislation. And that kind of physicality that he used on the stage, he brought to the film with all that really interesting body language, which did evoke Johnson. But it was actually the intensity and the intimate kind of passionate moments that I think he becomes even more Johnson-esque, if you will, in some of those super tight close-ups, you know, when when he's going at Humphrey or going at those other senators. And man, oh man, it's a thrill when you're sitting at the monitors and just seeing him do that take after take in all different levels of, you know, all different scales of intensity. And then you just get to choose what works in the cutting room.
And yet you still managed to find time to get Bryan Cranston a scene with his underwear out and naked, which seems to be a contract writer for him, whether Malcolm in the Middle, Breaking Bad.
Just, you have to deliver on that expectation. You can't not. And Johnson was famous for that. You know, that's one of his apocryphal tricks he would play on people to throw them off balance, is in the middle of a meeting, just drop his pants, sit on the toilet, and force you to continue to interact as if nothing is unusual. It's one of his, it must be a lost art, because I don't think I've been in many meetings that went that way, to really unsettle people and simultaneously flattering them and another moment threatening them and even bullying them. You know, the guy was incredibly persuasive. And by the way, one of the things that you can go to on the internet to get at this guy's incredible personality, it's kind of like they should, you know, offer many of these phone calls that he recorded up to business people and politicians just as a sort of lesson in persuasiveness, because, man, he just gave you no wiggle room when he wanted you to do something, you know, persuading Harry Truman to go on a big junket that he had to, you know, he wanted him to fill in for him, or Sergeant Shriver to take over the war on poverty when he was running the Peace Corps. Like, they were kind of reluctant, and by the end of the call, it's just, there's no way he's taking no for an answer. And those calls are all online. You can go right on the internet and just type in LBJ phone calls, and he recorded everything, and they're indexed, and you can kind of eavesdrop on his entire presidency.
So how high up the call sheet was Scotch while you were shooting this movie? Scotch is basically a character in the film.
There's a lot of drinking in the 60s, as you know, from Mad Men, a lot of smoking. And what you're glad there is not a lot of anymore is drinking and driving, which
right.
LBJ was famous for. He would, you know, have a big glass of scotch and ice while barreling down those dirt roads.
Well, the great scene where they drive into the lake, and it turns out it's like a car.
Yeah.
But where'd you find that?
The amphibious car was it's a real thing. They had them in the 60s. Johnson was a gadget freak. He had his own helicopter. Even in the 50s, he had his own helicopter. In the late 40s, maybe even, but certainly in the 50s, that he would use for campaigning. He had gadgets all over the house. He had phones under the dining room table on drawers that would just slide out. And he had an amphibious car. And he wouldn't – sometimes Doris Kearns Goodwin told us when she was on the ranch with him, he was talking to her, try to persuade her to stick around a little longer. And I forgot what he was trying to persuade her to do. But driving down the road, drinking, and swerves off into the lake, towards the lake. And is like, I got no brakes. And ends up in the water, of course. And doesn't reveal until they're, you know, already in horrible danger, evidently, that the car can float, has propellers and a motor, and then starts to talk her into what he wanted to, after she recovers, talks her into what he wanted to talk her into. So, and those do exist. They have a whole club of them now. There are a couple hundred of them in the world, and the Ampicar still lives. I bet you we'll have. We should have gotten product placement, because they should start remaking them.
One more question for you, Jay. Like, you've done now, you've tackled, you know, McCarthyism with Trumbo, and you've done Johnson and the beginning of the Civil Rights era, and the Florida recount, and the 2008
yeah.
election. Is there a political story that you haven't had a chance to tell that you would really like to?
Well, there are tons of them, and historically, but I'm completely riveted to what's going on right now. So,
and really, why?
Yeah,
what's interesting?
I don't know if I can tell a story that can get close to the kind of World Wrestling Federation reality show that's going on right this minute. And I suspect that where I will, if I do ever get into it, is just figuring out the backroom operatives trying to, especially in the case of Trump, like the people that he works for that are obviously going at all the other candidates, but the just imagining what it's like in those rooms where they're trying to figure out how to deal with him, you know, what oppositional research there, you know, like just all the strategizing within that party is really, I guess I probably in some ways already did it with the Sarah Palin movie, but I can't help but be fascinated with the spin doctors. That, to me, those people are always the most terrifying and the most interesting.
Cranston's got to put on some weight to play Trump. That's the only thing. Get some new hair.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, please release something else soon, because there's a lot of stuff we didn't get to. So put out another movie soon so we can have you back. Jay Roach.
Yeah, I'd love to come back.
That'd be great. Jay Roach is the director of All the Way. Debuts on HBO on May 21st. It is really good, so make sure you find time to watch it. Thanks so much for coming on, Jay. We really appreciate it.
Oh, man. Thank you, guys. Thanks for the interest. I really appreciate it.